I'm Eilif Trondsen, the project leader of the Nordic EdTech Network project, funded by Nordic Innovation. Today I have the honor and pleasure of interviewing my good friend Michael Carter, whom I've known for many, many years. Michael has been has very deep and extensive knowledge of and experience in education, learning, and technology. And you will soon hear a bit more about his background so you can understand where he's coming from and learn more about how he sees both emerging opportunities and challenges in the edtech industry, both here in Silicon Valley, in the United States more generally, and around the world. So let's get into it, Michael, and let me start by first welcoming you to the Nordic EdTech Network podcast series.
Thank you. I'm
great
honored
to have you here. We greatly appreciate you taking the time and to share some of your views and perspectives on what's happening around this fascinating industry. So I think it's appropriate that you start by sharing with our listeners a bit about your early days, and you go way back and maybe start with Apple and working for Steve Jobs. Not everyone has had that opportunity or had that challenge, maybe. And what have been some of the many interesting experiences you had in the edtech industry since those early days? So,
surely. Well, actually, I never worked for Steve. When I was at Apple, he had already been gone. So, but I started out in the 70s as a European history professor. I was teaching back in New Hampshire at Dartmouth College, and I was teaching the French European history and the French Revolution. And I wanted to do a game to help my students understand a particular concept in revolutionary history, the concept of revisionism. That is to say, during the reigns of terror, like in China under Mao or Stalin or Robespierre, there's a certain orthodoxy that you have to conform to, but then all of a sudden that orthodoxy changes. And the thing that people don't had a hard time understanding was that if you were a good guy yesterday, but now that would be a bad guy, you could get guillotined for having been a bad guy yesterday, even though you weren't. So I asked a friend of mine who was in the computer center, and back in those days we had time sharing systems, which was basically a terminal connected to a big, well, cloud, and teach me how to program. And so I wrote a game, and I tried it out on my students at Dartmouth, and they all liked it, and they all got the concept, and they all found it a very interesting way to learn. So all of a sudden back, I guess that was back in the spring of 77, I got really excited about computers and learning. So I at that time, I took a sabbatical to come out here to, back out here to California to write a book, a history book. And the guy who taught me to program, Art Lohrmann, who, by the way, was the fellow who coined the term computer literacy back in the 70s, gave me a letter of introduction to Steve Jobs at Apple and to Al Yu, who had left Intel to found a company called Umtech, which had a consumer product called the Video Brain, which was sort of a cross between a video game and a computer that sold for $500 at Macy's. And so I met them both, and in the case of Steve, that was actually before, that was the company wasn't quite a year old, and they didn't have a disk drive yet. That turned out to be the biggest innovation in their earliest days, that Wozniak figured out how to do a disk operating system. So basically, I know it's hard to imagine, but they were feeding code into the Apple II with an audio tape recorder, a cassette recorder. And it was very error-prone. So he said, well, no, we can't do your game. There's too much content. You know, it'll never, the computer doesn't have enough memory to remember it. So I ended up doing the game that I had imagined with Umtech for the Video Brain for a cartridge. So my first commercial video game was an educational video game on a 6 kilobyte ROM cartridge in 1978. So and then I went back to Dartmouth and taught for a couple of years, and then I came back out here and went to work at Stanford doing what we then called academic computing or courseware. And by that time, the Steves had a disk drive, and IBM about a year later had a personal computer. And so we spent a lot of time working with faculty in the 80s, helping them have ideas about how they could teach people things that they'd had trouble teaching them, like how to block out a scene in Shakespeare, or how to imagine the body temperature of an animal that goes out of a cave and lies on a rock, how a student in Japan navigated the higher ed system so that he would eventually be able to rise to the top in the corporate world. And it was an awful lot of fun working with people who had really good ideas and who all of a sudden had a medium, as it were, to to communicate those ideas to the kids. I saw Steve for dinner out in Pescadero at Duertz back in about 1980 and with his girlfriend. And I actually hired her to work on that project at Stanford, Barbara. But I didn't really work with him. I sort of, in the pre-Mac days, we reconnected because he had hired this fellow, Daniel Lewin, away from the LISA project to put together a consortium of universities to buy Macintoshes and resell them to their students. Because he'd had sort of a, this was typical. He was a really smart kid, but he really didn't know anything about higher ed, having dropped out. He took the president of Stanford University and the president of Harvard University out to lunch. And he said, "Hey, how would you like to like buy a whole bunch of this new computer that I'm making, you know, cheap?" And they didn't have any idea what to do with that. So they, of course, formed committees and there were discussions. And in fact, the current president of Stanford University was on that committee, as I recall. Anyway, so he got this guy, Dan Lewin, who put together a consortium of universities, 24 universities, to buy 2,000 Macs for $1,000 each, which was 40% of the actual announced retail price, and resell them to the students. And so that's pretty much where most of the Macs went in 1984. We at Stanford bought 2,000 and sold them in about 6 weeks, and then took longer to sell the second. And that's kind of what kept the Mac alive until the laser printer came aboard. Because, you should look at the info on your computer, but that was a 128 kilobyte RAM computer, the Macintosh. So you really – and it didn't have a hard drive. It just had, hard disks, floppy disks, those mini disks. So – there really wasn't a lot you can do with it. And in fact, Mac Write was so constrained that if you wrote one word more than 8 pages, the computer would crash and it would lose your file, which we found out the hard way when kids started writing papers in the spring on their Macs. So it was a lot of fun, but it was really kind of all about constraints, you know? Mm-hmm. And we at Stanford, we were a really good, you know, customer, I guess you'd say it. So I was on the advisory board to all these vendors, IBM, Apple, DEC, you remember DEC? Yeah. Hewlett-Packard, and we ran protection rackets on them saying essentially, you know, their computers wouldn't be adopted at Stanford if they couldn't be integrated in the curriculum, so why don't you write me a check for $250,000 and I'll hire a bunch of people to work with the faculty to do exemplary courseware, which we did, you know. And so it was a time when everybody was fantasizing about what we called in the consortium of universities, the 3M machine, a megabyte of memory, 1,000,000 pixels, and 1 MIPS processing power. MIPS were, you know, a measure that once upon a time was used to measure speed. So that gives you an idea of how primitive it was in mid-80s, you know.
So if you look back at this, you know, you obviously, and I know you could go on for a lot longer with other companies, and you can maybe touch upon that when some of the other questions. But if you look back at all of these, you know, this fascinating journey that you've been on and the set of experiences, how do you think these things are shaping your perspectives on today's edtech industry? Because now we are here in 2016, you have more of a, you know, historical perspective on these things than most people. And are you excited and optimistic about the future, given what you've seen? Or are you perhaps cautiously optimistic? Or do you have concerns about some of the trends that you've seen and where we're heading based on all of this experience you've had and what you've been through?
Oh, I think it's really fun, you know, stuff gets really, you know, I'm not as excited an earlier adopter as I used to be, you know, but mm-hmm. I think somebody does something practically every day that's totally cool, you know, that nobody else ever imagined. And the thing I think that's been persistent for me over the years, and I think I should probably credit John Kameny for getting me to look at this. He was president of Dartmouth College, and he was responsible for me being able to use computers because he was the one that got the time-sharing system developed there. And he was a real smart guy. You know, he'd literally been Einstein's research assistant when he was a grad student at Princeton. But he said, you know, well, people, it's hard to get people to adopt new technology. You know, they have to have a good reason to do that. So right. I started thinking about it, and what I've learned is that either people will adopt a new technology because there's a cost to that, right? You have to learn how to use it, and you have to stop doing what you were doing. Either because they can stop doing something they don't like doing, right. Or they can do something that they have always wanted to do but couldn't do, right? So, like, even in 1981, when we gave all the humanities faculty IBM PCs to replace their IBM Selectric typewriters as word processors, the main incentive for them was they didn't have to type the good words when they retyped a manuscript.
Right.
You only had to do a word processor, you know? And then in the 80s, we had all these wonderful examples of people doing things that they, oh, God, I really can't get my kids to get this, you know, and then they could. And as for getting discouraged, you know, the tagline in the 80s was something like, you know, don't get impatient. It took the overhead projector 10 years to come out of the bowling alley and get into the classroom, something like that, you know. Mm-hmm. And now there are all sorts of really of things that people have talked about all these years that are happening, you know, collective learning, the kind of sharing that we realize that now this generation of students do. It's really, we spend a lot of time studying kids on the internet about 10 years ago, and what we're realizing is knowledge is very, very social. And so all the tools, the social media tools and the tools that allow people to learn together are just fascinating. And since transactions are captured, and video is so easy to get, and that formative assessment is something within the reach of almost any teacher, you know, of really knowing what the kid's thinking when the kid
right.
reads a book, you know, and
right.
and we have these great simulations. I mean, the simulation I wrote to teach revisionism in 1977 was wasn't not only crude, it was really primitive, but now you have these really elaborate worlds, you know, that people walk around in, and you have VR, virtual reality, where you can take kids on field trips to places that have been buried for 1,000 years, you know, and you have AR, where the kids can integrate their physical experience with a whole digital overlay of information. So those are all really, really cool technologies, and the good news is finally, with most of them that have been around for a long time in a kind of a clunky way, they're finding applications in a commercial world, which means it's possible to use them for learning in a school setting, because you don't have to teach everybody what they are and how to use them, and you don't have to pay a lot of money for them, and you don't have to train people, you know. So yeah, so it's a cool time.
Yeah, I interviewed Jari Multisilta, and you probably know Jari from Finland, and he started thinking about use of video in learning and how kids could use video for storytelling and so on. And he recently launched a company, and his vision is that kids will be collaborating across borders and sharing videos and so on.
Yeah.
And when he first started thinking about it, you know, the smartphones were not really able to do that, but now the technology exists, and so now you can do things that they couldn't do when he first started thinking about developing this, and now he's turning it into a business. So
yeah, we did some very interesting experiments at Apple, and when I was there around the 89 to 93 in the Advanced Technology Group, the we dry lab, we rehearsed what it would be like to have wireless technology, what it would be like to have augmented reality technology, what it would be like for kids across the country to send videotapes and stuff. And now it's all coming true, and it's all just everyday stuff. It's really exciting.
So that leads me into the next question, and maybe I could get a little more specific on some of the opportunities, because obviously the Nordic EdTech listeners that are part of our community are thinking about this. Where are the biggest opportunities, and how can they take advantage of these things in the next few years? So what do you see? Now, you've done a lot of work in K-12. You've been in higher ed. You've done some things in direct-to-consumer, corporate learning. So are there certain of these areas that you see more significant opportunities? Because K-12, even though it's large, it can be difficult to get in and find the customers who will pay and then deal with the users and so on. So can you give our listeners, and if you want to give them some advice on the steps that you should think about taking as they think about these opportunities, and particularly for the Nordics and thinking about bigger markets here in the U.S. and elsewhere?
Well, in general, my older age, my principle for intervening with technology in learning is the shorter the better, meaning the younger the kid, the more leverage you're going to have in the kid's life by your intervention. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I think there's two exercises you have to do. The first one is putting on that lens I talked about, the lens that says, what's that person doing that they don't like doing? Is there a technology solution to take that pain in their ass out of their life, right? Or what does that person seem to want to do when you end up asking people, right?
Right.
What would you do if, you didn't have to spend all your time grading? What would you do with that time, right?
Right.
And you do that where you have been. You can go to some new place if you want, because it's supposed to be a ripe market. But by and large, I don't think that works so well. I mean, my friend Alan Louis, who was one of the co-founders of Imagine K-12, which is an incubator that's now a part of Y Combinator, makes a distinction between ed tech and tech ed. And he feels that people who are technologists that decide that, education is a cool market are the ones that have the least chance of succeeding. Because they don't really understand the practices and the protocols and the culture. So it's better to start with things that you're familiar with, or a good friend takes you to his or her world, and look at that. Look at what people are doing. And then when you see some opportunities there, well, then you look at the state of the shelf. You look around and you say, well, what's available to them to solve that problem? And then you look at who's doing something somewhere else, like consumer markets that could be adapted. So a fellow I know, Tim Young, basically sold his company to VMware for a lot of money because he convinced them that there was a cycle where consumer technology would be adopted by corporate, and the fax machine and email, and he sold them his basically enterprise Twitter company, So that was a case where somebody said, Twitter, Twitter, Twitter. What is that? What's going on there? What's happening? How could I use that to solve this teacher's problem? You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And now, for example, the project I'm working on, it's a nonprofit. It's called Text Genome. We just did a really cool exercise with Big History, which is this Bill Gates' pet project on the internet to teach history from the Big Bang, 13.7 billion years to now. But we called out the key vocabulary, and one thing that has changed is that corpora of texts are now digital. So you can actually do an analysis of an entire collection of a publisher's body of works in an instant. So as long as you have the right algorithms to study that, you can draw a tremendous amount of information. So, we're doing that with a professor who's been writing about this and doing it by hand for 40 years, and now she's got a computer scientist, cognitive scientist we work with, and she says, I want you to do this, and he does it in five minutes. You know? So,
now, Michael, I know you've also been a popular advisor and mentor to young entrepreneurs, including some from the Nordic region. So you come across, see what some of the challenges and obstacles are that these young entrepreneurs are facing and struggling with. And especially, many of them, they come to Silicon Valley and want to be part of this hot EdTech ecosystem that we have here, and including perhaps even seeking investment capital. Since we have a lot of very active EdTech investors here, probably more than anywhere else. So what are some of the things that you are seeing there in terms of these challenges and obstacles? And can you share some of the things that you've seen?
Well, there's what I would call the cultural chasm. Mm-hmm. But it's a blind spot for every entrepreneur, I mean, even Steve talked about the Macintosh as being the computer for the rest of us, which didn't include very many people for a long time. But another way of thinking about it is no mama's baby's ugly. You get somebody who's made a product and they really love it, and nobody wants to tell them that it's not, or it looks great where in this very small subset of reality in their hometown, but when they get out to a wider audience, it doesn't really, nobody thinks it's a beautiful baby,
Right.
That's
right.
One. The second thing is there's a classroom slash consumer channels, and they're different, but they overlap, and you have to really decide where you want to start and if you want to go into the other, because they have, each one of them has their own problems with the classroom channel. It's the sales cycle is 15 months long. With the consumer channel, it's virtually impossible to be discovered in the app store, And the other thing I try to get people to understand is to follow the money. It's a lot easier to go for new money that's been earmarked by the federal or state governments for education, right? Mm. Than it is to pick the pocket of someone like Pearson. Yeah. So right now, for example, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, it was STEM. Last year, it was pre-K, early education. Obama announced 2 months ago that the federal government's going to dedicate $4.1 billion to seeing that every child in America learns to code. So, yeah. You look for that money, because that's a gold rush. If you look to displace somebody who's there and has a sales force and a contract and stuff, you're going to bump up against the wall. And the last thing I think is to think, well, where do you really want to be in 5 years? Are you grooming your company for an IPO, or you just want to do this for a long time? And those seem like little things, but they're actually kind of keys to figuring out whether you can get enough traction at home, much less here, to get anybody's interest to invest in you.
Yeah. Following on to that, I don't know if I told you, but I interviewed Michael Statton from Learn Capital recently, and he noted that game-based learning, which of course is close to your heart, and by the way, which many aspiring Nordic edupreneurs are quite excited about, one of whom I talked to this morning, has been an area where Learn Capital has found to be quite challenging. So they had not really had the success in that area as they had hoped for. Now, since you've done so much work in the area, Michael, maybe you and you've seen a lot of things around game-based learning from the inside, and you've seen what players in this field are doing. What does it take to be successful, and not just in terms of creating something that has efficacy, that really works in teaching the kids to learn, as in over and beyond having some fun, but also creating something that can attract investors like Michael that I've had some struggles with it. So,
yeah, well, I think the basic problem is what Brenda Laurel characterized as chocolate cover broccoli. You know, people basically say, oh, this is really fun. No, it's not.
You take a bite and you realize what it is.
On the other hand, you know, 10 or so years ago, James Paul G, who used to be a professor of reading at University of Wisconsin-Madison, but now he's at Arizona State, he wrote a very interesting paper about games and learning and basically pointed out 24 different ways that good pedagogy in the classroom is just like good learning game, good game design. So once I read that article, I realized that people were having the wrong debate. You know, is it games or is it learning? Look, at the bar in a classroom is pretty low. It's a teacher standing up and talking at you, or it's a textbook, right? So it's pretty easy to do something more interesting than that that you're going to learn from. On the other hand, if you're out in the consumer world, you're competing with, like, you know, Angry Birds and Candy Crush Saga, and there are very high production values and a lot of money behind those. So, and plus there's all the confusion added by the gamification thing. The bottom line is, and Jane McGonigal, I think, is the most articulate writer about games and learning that I've ever met. It's really all about getting people on the right learning curve. It's not too steep, that it's frustrating, it's not too flat, that it's boring, and that's exactly the same thing for a game. So what you have to do is you have to design activities that involve, that keep the person interested, and the activities have to be designed in such a way that when you have finished the activity, you are competent in that thing, and that thing is worth something. From the point of view of the Common Core State Standards or the Next Generation Science Standards. And the good news is then you don't have to test it. One of the other things Jim G said was, you know, nobody takes a test to find out if they can play Worlds of Warcraft. They just play Worlds of Warcraft. Because the assessment, the formative assessment's built in. So, right. Yeah, and you know, there's a new book coming out at the end of July from Dan Schwartz, who's the dean at the School of Education at Stanford, called The ABCs of How We Learn. Mm-hmm. And they walk through 26 different ways that you can design activities so that people walk away having learned something. And I think that's probably going to be the most valuable contribution to games and learning since Jim G started writing about it back in about 2005.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to take too much more of your time, Michael. My last question focuses a little more on the Nordics and of course, we are involved in building bridges, and the Nordic EdTech Network is all about building bridges between the Nordics and Silicon Valley and the rest of the world, where there are exciting things happening around EdTech. And, you know, you've been to the Nordics, you've spoken with many Nordic EdTech entrepreneurs who are interested in what's happening here and so on. So do you have any departing thoughts and observations about the Nordic scene and any advice you want to give them in terms of things they might think about as they look ahead for the next 2-3 years and in terms of building the right things, planning in the right way, and particularly if they're thinking of coming over here?
Yeah, well, I think the irony is you've got a great brand. I mean, if you show that something works in a Finnish school system, then everybody in the world's going to say, well, that works. You know what I mean? Yeah, so it's really important. I mean, I wouldn't spend much time thinking about the investment and so on and so forth at first. It's important, you know, the product market fit's important, but what's more important is that the thing that you make people use and like. So pay enormous attention to what people are doing with and saying about and not liking and liking about something that you're asking them to use. You know, that right. Toca Boca is probably the best example. You know, they make great digital games, right? Wonderful games. And they're smart enough not to talk about them being learning games. Well, they're some of the best learning games that have ever been made, but because they don't argue that they're educational, no, they don't have to waste any time talking about that part. But when they design a game, they go through months of paper testing, literally drawing pictures on a piece of paper and bringing kids in and have play with it before they ever code anything. Mm-hmm. So it's that attention to your user and the user's experience and what they get out of it that is the best thing you can do locally. And once you've figured out a solution, then the Nordic brand, as it were, the respect people have for Scandinavian countries is going to carry you a very long way.
Yeah, that echoes exactly what Michael Staten said as well. He pointed out some of these things about the Nordic region that is really become well known over the last 3, 4, 5 years. Not just in terms of school systems or work, particularly in Finland, but also you have a region where people know technology, they have good infrastructure. A lot of things are in place to use that region as a test bed and to work with users, with learners, before you go into more competitive global markets and so on.
Yeah, well, I think anybody that's listened to this podcast should listen to the one with Michael. I think he's a very smart guy. I first met him down at the Games Lab, and I virtually everything he says or writes, I think, makes really good sense. So I would, if you've actually listened this far, I'd then go right back and listen to your interview with him.
Yeah, no, he had a lot of good things to say, and one of the things that was really interesting too, because you have probably heard of Kahoot. It's probably one of the Nordic edtech firms that has gotten most visibility over the last year in the United States. I think 3/4 of their users or more are here in the United States, and Michael said that company is the fastest growing company that he has ever seen in edtech.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Okay, Michael, well, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it, and I know I'll be seeing you soon, either down here in the valley or up in the city. Take care.
Thank you so much, Isla. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.